Now it's my honor to introduce Anjali Gopal. Anjali is a PhD student in bioengineering. She has been a member of the Effective Altruist community since 2014. She has volunteered at numerous EA global events and used to run the Bay Area Meetup for Effective Altruists. She has a strong interest in biosecurity and science policy, and that makes her the perfect person to interview Tom Khalil. Please welcome Anjali Gopal. Tom Khalil is a senior advisor to the Eric and Wendy Schmidt Group and an entrepreneur in residence at UC Berkeley. Previously, he was deputy director for technology and innovation for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and also the senior advisor for science, technology, and innovation for the National Economic Council. In these roles, he developed dozens of White House initiatives designed to foster American leadership in innovation, emerging technologies, and the industries of the future. Among many other roles, he has also been chair of the Global Health Working Group for the Clinton Global Initiative, where he developed new public and private sector initiatives in areas such as maternal and child health, undernutrition, and vaccines. Please welcome Tom Khalil. Take it away, guys.
Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you so much for joining us for this talk titled EAs and Policy Entrepreneurship. Before we begin, I just wanted to remind you that we are taking questions from the audience, so if you go onto the EA Global app, you'll be able to submit questions, which I'll select from throughout the course of this talk. And we are very excited to have Tom Khalil with us today, who has a remarkable history in science and technology policy, as Nathan mentioned. So let's get to it. So Tom, again, the title of the session is called Policy Entrepreneurship for Effective Altruists. And so what is policy entrepreneurship and how does this differ from traditional positions that people might think of in science and technology policy?
So in the same way that an entrepreneur in the private sector is attempting to develop a new product or service that meets an unmet need in the marketplace, the policy entrepreneur is identifying some significant area where he or she believes that some improvement is possible in the area of public policy. And I think that there are at least two types of policy entrepreneurs. So one might be someone who is really focused on one specific policy idea. So for example, I had members of my team that were really focused on one goal, which is how could they reduce the waiting list for an organ transplant? And they just focused on that. And then the role that I was playing was to see how many people like that I could recruit to the White House. So I was interested in a much broader range of policy ideas as opposed to being focused on one idea.
Right. And in your role, you were able to work with quite a diverse team of individuals. Can you tell us a little bit about their background and like what kind of ideas they were interested in?
Yeah. So I can give you a couple of examples. So I got an email from a young woman who is doing a postdoc at Stanford in decision neuroscience, and she had been a child violin prodigy with Itzhak Perlman and was a Rhodes Scholar, so I decided to take a chance on her.
Yeah.
And what she was interested in was replicating a program that the British government had done, which is the Behavioral Insights Team, which is can we take what we know about how people make decisions and apply that to public policy. So one example of this is that it turns out that you can dramatically increase the savings rate by allowing companies to permit automatic enrollment in IRAs. So what she was interested in is can we take those types of insights from the social and behavioral sciences and use them to improve both the design and implementation of public policy. And then she was able to recruit another 20 people, primarily PhDs in areas like social psychology and behavioral economics, to come and work for the government.
And in some of our past conversations, you also seem to mention that there seemed to be a natural fit between people who are interested in effective altruism and evidence-based policy. Can you talk a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so the idea of evidence-based policy is that we should do more things that work and fewer things that don't work, and that you should try to use evidence where it exists. So an example of that might be there's a growing trend to try to use randomized controlled trials to do impact evaluation. And so where there is evidence, you should try to act in accordance with that evidence, and if that evidence doesn't exist, you should try to build it. So an example of this is that in a lot of instances, we just don't know which interventions work. So in some cases, the administration developed programs that would provide small grants for new ideas worth trying, medium-sized grants to validate promising approaches with rigorous evaluation, and then larger grants to scale things up. So I think that you know, this focus on empathy and rationality that are hallmarks of the EA community are things that are really well aligned with this growing interest in evidence-based policy.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the implementation of policy ideas that your team did, which is where I think your expertise really shines. So for instance, you mentioned that as a policy entrepreneur, it's important to have influence without authority. What does that mean, and how does that help?
Yeah, so in a lot of cases, what you have to be good at doing is building coalitions. So it's not the case, you know, for example, if you are the head of an organization, and everything that you need to be that you need to do, you can do simply by the command and control relationship with the members of your team, you know, then it's pretty straightforward to get things done. But if you're in a situation where there are a number of other actors whose collaboration and cooperation you need, and you're not in a position to just sort of direct them to do things, but you need to convince them that this is like a genuinely good idea, then this skill of influence without authority is really, really important.
And how does this tie into the magic laptop thought experiment that you often talk about?
Sure, yeah. So in any job that you have some notion of what in your environment is fixed and what is potentially changeable. So for example, if you imagine that you're a professor at a university, if you have a great idea, you could write a grant to a funding agency, and then if you're successful, recruit graduate students and postdocs to help you out with the research. So that would be your lever. So my view was that if you had the ability to send a decision memo to the president, and have him check the box that said yes, that your view of at least what was potentially changeable should be pretty expansive. And so the thought experiment that I would pose to the members of my team is that you have a magic laptop. The power of the laptop is that any press release that you write will come true. And what you have to do is to generate a headline, which is the goal statement, several paragraphs that provide context, and paragraph-level descriptions of who is agreeing to do what in order to achieve the goal. And the reason that I thought that is important is that, you know, if you're trying to drive change in the world, if you're trying to address some of the problems that we've been talking about, like improving our ability to be prepared for pandemics, then ultimately some set of individuals and organizations is going to have to do something. And so if you can't articulate who would need to do what and how plausible is it that they would be both willing and able to take that action that you're identified, that you're still in research mode. Once you've identified, okay, in order to make progress in the following area, these are the people that I need to get on board, you can begin to assess how plausible it is that they would be willing to take that particular action.
So one of the other areas that I wanted to touch on was how this ties into career choices or options that lots of people in effective altruism would think of. So first of all, is there like a demonstrated skill set that you looked for in the members of your team when they were joining, like in terms of implementation or just expertise in policy or expertise in science and technology?
Yeah, so I had people with a pretty broad range of skills. You know, so I had people, you know, someone who is an MIT PhD in biological engineering. I had other people who had more of a legal background. So I really had people with a pretty broad range of skills. One of the things that I was looking for is, was there something that they were intrinsically motivated by? Because, you know, one of the things about government is that change does not usually occur overnight. And so having a certain amount of grit and persistence, what we used to call water on stone, was really useful. So what I was interested in is, did they at least have some initial hypothesis about how they wanted to use the position to drive change and to move the ball forward in some area? And that might evolve over time, but if they had no idea of, you know, there was no set of policy issues that they were really genuinely excited about working on, then I think they would not be able to take advantage of the opportunity.
And so is that how you would determine if policy was a good fit for you and whether you would find it enjoyable if there's a specific issue that you're really passionate about?
I think there's a large number of skills that are really useful. So I think we talked about one, which is how good are you at eliciting cooperation and collaboration between people who don't report to you? So that is one really valuable skill. Another skill is the ability to communicate with different types of people. So, for example, if we were doing something that required doing a presidential event, in other words, the president of the United States shows up, maybe he travels somewhere, he goes to some particular place, he's giving remarks, the administration is making some new policy announcement related to science and technology, the number of different types of people that you would need to interact with to make that a success would be pretty large, right? So the communications people would be asking, like, what's the story? Why do you believe that this is going to generate positive press coverage for the administration? If it's something that was going to cost money, you would need to interact with the Office of Management Budget, and they would want to know, how much is this going to cost? And do we have the resources for this? You might have to deal with the Office of Legislative Affairs, the people who are trying to ensure that members of the House and Senate are going to be supportive of this. So the number of different people that you would need to interact with to successfully launch something is large, and so therefore your ability to understand where they're coming from and what constitutes success for them was also really important.
Kind of in the same boat, you mentioned a lot of skills that's needed for someone to go into policy, and I think with careers like science and technology, it's especially interesting because there are multiple paths that you can go through. So do you have any advice for someone who might be considering a career in, say, direct science research or science and technology research versus considering something like science and technology policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that so the reason that I found it really rewarding to get involved in science and technology policy is the ability to have impact at a larger scale that might be possible as an individual researcher. Of course, you know, there are individual researchers who wind up having a huge impact because they wind up making some really fundamental breakthrough, or they develop a, you know, platform technology that has a large impact. So that's why I certainly found it to be something that was rewarding, is the ability to have impact at scale that would be difficult to do anywhere else.
I'm just going to check the audience questions very quickly. So a couple of the questions that are coming in, again, talk about what kind of credentials you might need to go into policy. So say someone is pretty new in their career and is interested in going into these roles. What kind of experience do you think they would need to gain to prove themselves to get into a position like policy entrepreneurship?
Yeah, so I'll say a little bit about the path that I took and also the path that other people took. So one path that I saw is that people will get a PhD in science and engineering, mm-hmm. And then they would do a fellowship through an organization like the National Academy of Sciences or the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So that was one pretty typical career trajectory that I saw. Another one is that people would wind up working on the Hill for a member of the House or the Senate, or they might work on one of the congressional committees. So a number of the people at the White House had some former Hill works at some point in their career. Think tanks, so there was some movement from think tanks to the administration. The path that I took was actually working on presidential campaigns. So every campaign has a department called the Issues Department, which is responsible for generating the candidates' position papers, getting them ready for debates, managing outside networks of advisors, responding to questionnaires, making sure that the candidate is briefed about the policy issues that are important to people in different states and regions. And that doesn't train you to be a specialist in any one particular area, but it allows you to get up to speed rapidly on a new issue in a very short period of time.
One other question would be in terms of having an impact in politics. Do you have any thoughts between going into work at a federal level versus at a state or a municipal level? Is it easier or faster to do it in certain levels, and is there more impact in other levels?
Yeah, so it depends what issue you're interested in. There are a lot of issues where states have an enormous impact. I would say if you're interested in the allocation of research and development dollars, then you're more likely to have an impact at the federal level. The federal government invests $150 billion a year in research and development, and a very modest amount of investment occurs at the state and local level. But there are lots of areas where state-level policy can have a big impact. But, you know, if you're looking at an area like energy and climate policy, for example, California has really been a pioneer in terms of trying to figure out how to accelerate the transition to a low-carbon economy.
One of the other things that I think would be interesting to a lot of effective altruists is that one of the most striking aspects of your work with OSTP is that you seem to have a very big appetite for a long-term vision. So, for instance, your leadership in the implementation of the National Nanotechnology Initiative was critical for how nanotechnology research accelerated, and especially in the early 2000s when nano wasn't as much of a buzzword as it is now. And I think these types of issues are of relevance to people interested in effective altruism who are also interested in looking at issues such as advancements in AI or synthetic biology. So what sort of advice would you have for people who want to take these ideas and look at policy implementation?
Yeah, so one of the things that was really valuable to me was just having a lot of people both inside the government and outside the government that were bringing ideas to whatever organization that I was working for, whether it was the Office of Science and Technology Policy and the National Economic Council, and also always to be asking the external community questions. So one of the questions that I would ask people is, in the same way that President Kennedy said, let's put an astronaut on the moon by the end of the decade, or we made the decision to sequence the human genome and to drive down the cost of that from 100 million to 1,000, what are the similarly ambitious goals that we should be setting in the 21st century? And every once in a while, I would get a really good answer to that question. So one example was the idea for what ultimately became the Brain Initiative. So the hypothesis is that one of the things that limits our understanding of how the brain works is that we don't have the tools that we need to be able to measure the brain in action. We don't have the ability to measure the real-time electrical and chemical interactions of large-scale neural circuits. And if we could, that would improve our understanding of how the brain works. It would improve our ability to diagnose, treat, and prevent diseases of the brain. And it could lead to new forms of computing that are inspired by how the brain works. So that's an idea that bubbled up from the research community. And I and my colleagues were able to help get $3 billion in funding for that idea from the public and private sector.
Similarly, do you have any issues in technology policy in the that you think are particularly pressing in the next 10 or 20 years? I know we talked a little bit about your work in the past, but...
Yeah, so, there are a lot of issues that I think are really important. I think one concern is that if you look at the history of the federal government, a much larger fraction of the budget used to go into... what we would term investment, that is investment in research and development, in human capital and infrastructure. And one of the things that has occurred in sort of a gradual way is that less and less of the federal budget goes into things that have the potential to create the foundation for long-term economic growth and job creation and productivity. So that's something that I'm really worried about, that the United States is allowing investment in agencies like the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, to gradually decline in terms of their real purchasing power. So that's something I'm really concerned about. You know, I also think that there are a lot of challenges that we face as a society where we're not really serious about leveraging science and technology. So we make large investments in R&D in areas like national security and health and space and a couple of other areas like that. But economic and social mobility, which is one of the big challenges that we face. So, for example, for non-college educated workers, we're seeing declining levels of labor force participation, declining real wages. We're really not thinking about how we might harness advances in science and technology to try to address that problem. So those are a couple that are kind of top of mind for me.
And one issue that we haven't really touched on is this issue of partisan politics. And I think that's especially relevant to the U.S. So I think a lot of people are hesitant to go into policy-related issues because of this. Do you have anything to say in response to that?
Sure, yeah. So there are lots of different types of roles that you can play in the federal government. So there are some people who are career employees, so they might stay there for a long time, and they're there regardless of which party is in power. So that's one thing. Then you have people like myself. I was a political appointee, so we all submit our letters of resignation when there is a change from one president to the next. And there, you know, you are having to sign up for the overall program of a particular president. The third, and this has started more recently, is the notion of a tour of duty. So, for example, we recruited a number of people with technical skills to help improve the delivery of government services. And so these were people who were from, you know, Google and Facebook and Amazon and Microsoft. They were not going to become full-time government employees and stay there for, you know, 30 years. They just saw it as an opportunity to give back, and it was really very obvious to them that the federal government really needed their help. So they were willing to come in and do these short tours of duty that might be range in anything from a discovery sprint that is, you know, looking at a particular federal IT system, or maybe coming in for a couple years to help solve some particular problem, like how could we dramatically reduce the time for veterans to get their health benefits?
And so also in the last few, or I guess in the last year, you've moved out of a policy role and you're working at the Eric and Wendy Schmidt Foundation. How does your work kind of tie into some of your past experience?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm working on is identifying scientific research that I'm excited about and I think are going to be aligned with the goals of Eric and Wendy. And one of the things that I think you need to do in philanthropy is to say, number one, what is the private sector unlikely to do? Because obviously the private sector invests a lot more in research and development than philanthropy is going to do. So if you're doing something that they're in a position to do, that doesn't seem like a good use of money. And then the other thing is, what is the government not doing? So, for example, one concern among researchers is that in some cases, the government is only able to fund 10 to 15% of the research proposals that are coming in. And so when you get a scientist around a table evaluating which of the proposals they're going to fund, if they're only able to fund a fraction of the proposal, sometimes they're more likely to go for the sure thing, and therefore not to support research that is high risk and high return. So I think that philanthropy may be able to make some riskier bets before the researchers have a lot of preliminary evidence to support their hypothesis.
So we have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to wrap up with some final questions from the audience. So one question asks, what is the potential impact for innovation at the international level versus the national level? So I know we talked about municipal and state levels a lot, but what about the international playing field?
Yeah, so I want to talk about an idea that I'm really excited about, which is what are the opportunities to use innovation to help address global public goods that, again, the private sector, left to its own devices, is unlikely to invest in. So there was some work by Michael Kramer, who's a Harvard economist, and I think he's been to some former, some EA meetings in the past. And he was really interested in the question of addressing the market failure associated with vaccines for diseases of the poor. And the market failure is left to their own devices. Vaccine companies won't work on vaccines for diseases of the poor. So he came up with this clever idea called an advanced market commitment, which you can think of as a purchase order for a product that doesn't exist yet. So as a result of his work and the work of people like Ruth Kramer, who's now at the Hewlett Foundation, five countries and the Gates Foundation committed to both Pfizer and GSK that if they developed a vaccine that was safe and effective, that they would purchase millions of doses of the vaccine at $7 a dose. And that one intervention was sufficient to save the lives of 7 million poor kids over the next 20 years. So I think identifying those areas where innovation can make a big difference to solving a global public good like global health. Another one that would be at the top of my list is addressing antibiotic-resistant bacteria. One of the projects I worked on was, could we dramatically reduce the time necessary to go from bug to drug? So I'm really interested in the role that innovation can play in addressing some of these challenges at the global level.
And then a final question in our last couple of minutes. So one person writes, you spoke about needing to be intrinsically motivated about a certain issue to be a successful political entrepreneur. But for people who are interested in working on a range of policy issues, do you recommend picking one issue specifically?
I think it's useful generally when you're first starting out. So I think that you're more likely to be able to move to in a position where you get to work on a broader range of issues, sort of mid-career. But I think it's at least helpful to have at least one idea, right? You might eventually decide that there are a bunch of things that you'd like to work on. But if you can't articulate one specific thing that you want to do. And I should say that there are opportunities for people who are libertarians, because what they can work on is to reduce the number of things that the government is doing, and that requires policy entrepreneurship as well.
And have you seen people kind of transition from one particular project into another one?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think particularly in the White House, where there are just fewer people, and there are a broader range of issues that you have to cover. So people will wind up covering a broader portfolio than if they're working in an agency and therefore are a lot more likely to be focused on one particular issue.
Okay, so that's about all the time we have for this talk. Thank you so much for all of the insight that you've provided and your
sure.
expertise.
Sure.